What was the feeling? I don't know who was there, but we wanted to reach the campfire very badly. Is there a sandy area nearby? Yin pulled the jeep off the road and stopped. The haze was beginning to lift. This landscape is all rocky sand for another 100 miles, Yin said. I shrugged my shoulders. What about a river? Is there a river somewhere close? Yin's eyes lit up. Yes! Just past the next town, Paryang, about 150 miles up ahead. He paused for a moment, smiling broadly. We must stay very alert, he said. It is our only lead. We made good time, reaching Paryang by sunset. We drove straight through town and then on for another 15 miles, where Yin turned off to the right on a track road. It was almost completely dark, but we could see the river half a mile ahead. There is a checkpoint up ahead, he explained. We have to go around it. As we approached the river, the road narrowed and became extremely rutted. What's that? Yin asked, stopping the jeep and backing up. Off in a rocky clearing to our right, barely visible, was a vehicle. I rolled down the side window so we could see more clearly. It's not a van, Yin said. It's a blue Land Cruiser. I strained to see. Wait a minute, I said. That's the vehicle I saw at the roadblock when we were separated. Yin shut off our headlights, and the darkness seemed to engulf us. Let's go on a little farther, he said, pulling the jeep forward through the deep ruts for several hundred more feet. Look, I said, pointing. To our left was the van, parked between large rocks. No one was around. I was about to get out when Yin lurched the jeep forward and parked it out of sight several hundred yards to the east. Better to hide our vehicle, he commented, locking it up as we got out. We returned to the van and looked around. The footprints go in this direction, Yin said, gesturing toward the south. Come on. I walked behind him as we made our way through the large rocks and sand. A three-quarter moon lit our way. After about 10 minutes, he looked at me and sniffed. I could smell it, too, the smoke of a fire. We walked another 50 yards in the darkness until we saw a campfire. A man and a woman were huddled around it. It was the Dutch couple I had seen in the van. The river was just beyond. What do we do? I whispered. We'll have to announce ourselves, he said. You had better do it, so they will be less afraid. We don't know who they are, I said, resisting. Go ahead. Tell them we are here. I looked at them more closely. They were dressed in fatigues and thick cotton shirts. They looked like mere tourists trekking into Tibet. Hello, I said in a loud voice. We're glad to see you. Yin looked at me askance. The two people jumped up and stared closely as I emerged from the darkness. Smiling broadly, I said, we need your help. Yin followed, bowing slightly, and said, we are sorry to disturb you, but we are looking for our friend, Wilson James. We were hoping you could help us. They were both in shock, not believing we had walked into their camp this way. But slowly, the woman seemed to realize we were harmless and offered us a place to sit beside the fire. We do not know Wilson James, she said, but the man we are here to meet does know him. I have heard him mention the name. Her companion nodded, looking very nervous. I hope Jacob can find us. He is hours late. I was about to tell them that we had seen the Land Cruiser parked not too far away when the expression on the man's face changed. He looked petrified. His eyes were glued to something behind me. I jerked around. Back in the direction of the vehicles, the terrain had come alive with other vehicles and headlights and dozens of voices speaking in Chinese, all moving in our direction. The man leaped to his feet and extinguished the fire. He grabbed several packs and ran out of the camp with the woman. Come on, Yin said, trying to catch up with him. Within several minutes, they had disappeared in the darkness. Finally, Yin gave up. Behind us, the lights were getting closer, and we huddled by the river. I think I can make my way around to our jeep, Yin said. If we are lucky, they haven't found it yet. You head north, upstream, for about a mile, and try to outdistance them. You will find another road there that comes down to the river's edge. Listen for me, and I'll pick you up. Why can't I go with you? I asked. Because it is too dangerous. One man might get through, the two would be seen. Reluctantly, I agreed, and began to make my way through the rocks and gravel mounds in the moonlight, using my flashlight only when absolutely necessary. I knew Yin's plan was crazy, but it seemed to be our only chance. I wondered what would have been learned if we had talked longer to the Dutch couple or met the other man. After about 10 minutes, I stopped to rest. I was cold and tired. I heard a rustling ahead of me. I strained to hear. Someone was definitely walking. It must be the Dutch couple, I thought. Slowly I made my way forward until I caught up with the sound. 20 feet away, I could see the silhouette of only one person, a man. I knew I had to say something or risk losing him. "Are you Dutch?" I stammered, thinking that this might be the man the couple was waiting to meet. He froze and said nothing, so I repeated the question. It sounded silly, but I thought perhaps I would get some kind of response. "Who is it?" came a reply. "I'm an American," I said. "I've seen your friends." He turned and looked at me as I struggled through the rocks to reach him. He was young, perhaps 25, and looked terrified. "Where did you see my friends?" he asked, his voice shaking. As he focused on me, I could feel how afraid he was. A wave of fear swept through my body, too, and I struggled to keep up my energy. "Back downstream," I replied. "They told us they were waiting for you." "Where's the Chinese there?" he asked. "Yes, but I think your friends got away." He looked even more panicked. "They told us," I said quickly, "that you know a man I'm looking for. Wilson James." He was backing up. "I've got to get out of here," he said, turning to leave. "I've seen you before," I said. "You were detained at a checkpoint in Zhongba." "Yes," he said. "You were there?" "I was behind you in the traffic. You were being questioned by a Chinese official." "That's right," he replied, nervously looking in all directions. "What about Will?" I asked, struggling to stay calm. "Wilson James, do you know him? Did he tell you anything about a gateway?" The young man didn't say anything. His eyes were glazed over with fear. He just turned and ran back through the rocks, heading farther upstream. I chased him for a while, but soon he disappeared into the darkness. Finally, I stopped and looked back toward where the van and our jeep were parked. I could still see lights and hear muffled voices. I turned and headed north again, realizing full well that I had blown my chance. I had gotten no information from him. I tried to shrug off the failure. More important was finding Yin and trying to get away myself. Eventually, I found the old road, and minutes later, I heard the faint sound of a jeep. 5. The Contagion of Awareness. I stretched out as best I could in the cramped vehicle. I was completely exhausted, and I wondered how Yin had the strength to drive. I knew he had been fortunate. As Yin had supposed, the Chinese military had seemed disorganized and nonchalant about their search. They had posted a single guard at the Dutch couple's van, while the others half-heartedly searched in the other direction, totally overlooking our jeep. Yin had managed to start it up without making much noise and move around them undetected to pick me up at the river. At this point, Yin was still driving with the headlights off and staring intently through the windshield to see the darkened road. After a moment, he glanced over at me. "The young Dutchman you saw didn't tell you anything?" "That's right," I said. "He was too frightened. He just ran away." Yin was shaking his head. "This is my fault. If only I had told you about the next prayer extension, the third, you would have been more effective at getting the information." I began to question what he meant, but he waved me off with his hand. "Just remember where you are," he instructed. "You have experienced the first extension, connecting with the energy and letting it flow through you, visualizing that it forms a field of energy that flows ahead of you wherever you go. The second extension, as I have been explaining, is setting your field of energy so that it will enhance your life flow. You do this by staying ever alert and expectant. The third extension is setting your prayer field to go out and increase the energy and vibrational levels of others. When your prayer field reaches other people in this way, they feel a hit of spiritual energy, clarity, intuition, and they will be more likely to give you the right information. Again, I knew exactly what he was getting at. Under the tutorship of Will and Sanchez in Peru, I had explored how to send energy to other people as a new ethical stance toward others. Now Yin seemed to be clarifying how to do this more effectively. "I know what you mean," I said. "I was taught that there's a higher self-expression that can be found on every person's face. If we speak to that self, that expression, our energy helps to lift the person into higher self-awareness." "Yes," Yin responded, "but this effect is increased if one knows how to extend one's prayer field the way the legends explain. We must expect our prayer field to go out in front of us and increase other people's vibration at a distance, even before we are close enough to see their faces." I regarded him questioningly. "Look at it this way. If you are truly practicing the first extension, the energy is coming into you and you are seeing the world more as it really is. Colorful, vibrant, beautiful, like a magic forest or a colorful desert. Now, to practice the third extension, you must consciously visualize that your energy is overflowing into the field of everyone around you and lifting their vibration so that they too begin to see the world as it really is. Once this happens, they can slow down and sense the synchronicity. After setting our fields in this manner, it is easier to observe the higher self-expression on the faces of others." He paused and looked over at me as though he had just thought of something else. "Remember, too," he continued, "that there are pitfalls that must be avoided when you uplift someone. Each face is a pattern of features, like an ink blot, and you can see many things there. You can see the anger of your abusive father, the aloofness of an uncaring mother, or the face of someone who has threatened you. This is a projection from your past, a perception created by a traumatic situation that has colored how you expect others to act. When you see someone who even slightly resembles someone who has done you wrong, the tendency is to expect that person to be the same way. This problem is very important to understand and must be monitored closely. We all must get beyond expectations dictated by our past experiences. Do you understand?" I nodded, anxious for him to proceed. "Now, think again of what happened to you at the hotel in Kathmandu. We must look at that more closely. Didn't you say that the man at the pool changed the mood of everyone when he sat down?" I nodded again, thinking back. That was exactly right. The man had seemed to bring a new mood into the pool area before he had even said a word. "That occurred because his energy was already set to enter the energy field of others and give them a positive boost. Think of how that felt. Exactly." I looked away for a moment, trying to recreate what had happened. Finally, I said, "Everyone in the area seemed to go from a state of irritation and discontent to a state of mind that was more open and conversant. It's hard to explain." "His energy opened you up to explore something new," Yin continued, "instead of being stuck in dread or despair or whatever else you people were feeling." Yin stopped talking briefly, looking closely at me. "Of course," he went on, "it could have gone the other way. If the man hadn't been strong enough in his energy as he walked into the pool area, he might have been overwhelmed by the low energy state of the rest of you and been brought down to your level. That's what happened to you when you met the young Hollander. He was terrified and his fear affected you. You let his mood prevail. You see, the energy fields of all of us mix together out there, and the strongest ones prevail. That's the unconscious dynamic that characterizes the human world. The state of our energy, our prevailing expectations, no matter what they are, go out and influence everyone else's mood and attitude. The level of awareness between humans and all the expectations that go with it are contagious. This fact explains the great mysteries of crowd behavior, why decent people, influenced by a few who are in great fear or anger, can get caught up in lynchings, riots, or other despicable deeds. It also explains why hypnosis works and why movies and television have such great influence on the weak-minded. the prayer field of each person on earth intermingles with all the others, creating all the norms and group affiliations and national mindsets and ethnic hostilities that we see out there. Yen smiled. Culture is contagious. Just travel to a foreign land and see how the people not only think differently, but feel differently as a matter of mood and outlook. This is a reality that we must understand and master. We must remember to consciously use the third extension. When we are relating to people and find that we are taking on their mood, becoming overcome with their expectations, we have to go back and fill up again and overflow very consciously until the mood elevates. If only you could have done this with the young Dutchman, you might have found out about Will. I was impressed. Yen seemed to have a full mastery of this information. Yen, I said, you're a scholar. His smile faded. There's a difference between knowing how all this works, he replied, and being able to do it. I must have slept for hours because when I awoke, the sun was out and the jeep was pulled off onto a flat area above the road. I stretched, then collapsed back into the seat. For a few minutes, I stared out past several mounds of rocks at the gravel highway below us. A nomad, leading a horse and small wagon, trod by, but otherwise, the road was empty. The sky was crystal clear, and from somewhere behind us I could hear a bird's call. I took a breath. Some of the tenseness from the day before had eased. Yen slowly began to move, and then sat up, glancing over at me with a smile. He stepped out of the jeep and stretched, then pulled a camp stove from the back and put on a pan of water for oatmeal and tea. I joined him and again tried to follow him through a set of difficult Tai Chi exercises. From behind us, we heard a vehicle racing down the road. We waited behind a rock as the Land Cruiser sped by, both of us recognizing it at the same time. "That's the young Hollander," Yen said, running to the jeep. I grabbed the camp stove and threw it into the back and hopped into the vehicle as Yen was turning around. "We'll be fortunate to catch him at that speed," Yen commented as we gave chase. We drove over a small hill and down into a narrow valley, finally catching a glimpse of the vehicle cruising down the road several hundred yards ahead of us. "We have to reach out to him with our prayer energy," Yen said. I took a deep breath, visualizing my energy outflowing up the road and into the Land Cruiser and having an effect on the young man. I imagined him slowing down and stopping. As I sent the image, the vehicle actually sped up, pulling away from us. I was confused. "What are you doing?" Yen yelled, looking over at me. "I'm using my field to make him stop." "Don't use your energy that way," Yen said quickly. "It has the opposite effect." I looked at him blankly. "What do you do," Yen asked, "when someone tries to manipulate you into doing something?" "I resist it," I said. "That's right," Yen went on. "At the unconscious level, the Hollander can feel you trying to tell him what to do. He feels manipulated, and that gives him the sense that whoever is behind him is up to no good, which produces more fear and adds to his determination to flee. All we can do is visualize our energy reaching out and increasing his level of vibration overall. This allows him to more fully overcome the fear and get in touch with his higher self intuitions, which hopefully will lead him to be less afraid of us and to maybe risk a conversation. That's all we can do with our prayer energy. To do anything else is to presume that we know his best life course, but only he knows that. Perhaps it will be that his higher intuition, once we send him enough energy, is to dump us and get out of the country. We have to be open to that. All we can do is help him make the decision from the highest possible level of energy. We rounded a curve in the road, and the blue Land Cruiser was nowhere to be seen. Yen slowed down. To our right was a smaller road that seemed to stand out in appearance. "That way," I said, pointing. 100 yards ahead, at the bottom of a small hill, was a wide but shallow tributary. In the middle was the Dutchman's vehicle, racing its engine, spinning its wheels, and spattering mud, but going nowhere. It was stuck. The young man glanced back at us and opened the door, preparing to run, but when he recognized me, he shut off the engine and got out in the knee-deep water. As we pulled our jeep alongside, Yim looked at me closely, and I could tell from his expression that he was reminding me to use my energy. I nodded to him. "We can help you," I said to the young man. He eyed us suspiciously for a moment, but gradually warmed as Yim and I got out and pushed the fender of the Land Cruiser as he gunned the engine. Its wheels spun for a moment, spewing mud against my pant leg, then it leaped out of the hole and crossed to the other side of the river. We followed in our jeep. The young man looked at us for a moment as though deciding whether to drive away, but got out and walked back toward us. As he approached, we introduced ourselves. He told us his name was Jacob. As we spoke, I began to look for the wisest expression I could find on his face. Jacob was shaking his head, still terrified, and spent several minutes finding out who we were and querying us further about his missing friends. "I don't know why I came to Tibet," he said finally. "I always thought it was too dangerous, but my friends wanted me to come with them. I have no idea why I agreed. My God, there were Chinese soldiers everywhere. How did they know we were going to be there?" "Did you ask for directions from anyone you didn't know?" Yim asked. He looked hard at us. "I did. Do you think they told the soldiers?" Yim nodded, and Jacob seemed to go deeper into panic, looking around in all directions nervously. "Jacob," I asked, "I have to know, did you meet Wilson James?" Jacob still seemed unable to focus. "How do we know the Chinese aren't right behind us?" I tried to catch his eye, finally managing to get him to look at me. "This is important, Jacob. Do you remember seeing Will? He looks Peruvian, but he speaks with an American accent." Jacob still looked confused. "Why is this important? We must find a way out of here." As we listened, Jacob made several suggestions about where we might camp until the Chinese left the area, or better yet, how we might make a mad dash across the Himalayas into India. I continued to visualize my energy going into him and to focus on his face, looking for an expression of calmness and wisdom in his features, especially in his eyes. Finally, he began to look at me. "Why do you want to find this man?" he asked. "We believe that he needs our help. He is the man who asked me to come to Tibet." He looked at me for a moment, apparently trying to focus. "Yes," he said finally, "I did meet your friend. He was in the lobby of a hotel in Lhasa. We were sitting across from each other and started talking about the Chinese occupation. I've been incensed about the Chinese for a long time, and I guess the reason I came here was that I wanted to do something, anything. Will told me he had seen me 3 times that day at various locations in the hotel, and that it meant something. I didn't know what he was talking about." "Did he mention a place called Shambhala?" I asked. He looked interested. "Not exactly. He mentioned something in passing, something about Tibet not being freed until Shambhala was understood, something like that. Did he mention a gateway?" "I don't think so. I can't remember much of the conversation. It was really very brief." "What about his destination?" Yim asked. "Did he mention where he was going?" Jacob looked away, thinking, then said, "I think he mentioned a place called Dorma, I think it was, and something else about the ruins of an old monastery there." I looked at Yim. "I know that place," he said. "It's in the far northwest, 4 or 5 days' travel. It will be rough and cold." The thought of having to travel that far into the wilderness of Tibet sent my energy crashing. "Do you want to come with us?" Yim asked Jacob. "Oh, no," he said. "I have to get out of here." "Are you sure?" Yim pressed. "The Chinese seem to be very active right now." "I can't," Jacob said, looking away. "I'm the only one left to contact my government and look for my friends, if I can find a way to get help." Yim scribbled out something on a piece of paper and handed it to Jacob. "Find a phone and call this number," Yim said. "Mention my name and give them a return number. Once they check you out, they will call and tell you what to do." Yim went on to tell Jacob the best way back to Saga, and we walked with him as he made his way back to his Land Cruiser. Once he had climbed inside, he said, "Good luck. I hope you find your friend." I nodded. "If you do," he added, "then maybe it will turn out that this is why I came to Tibet, huh? So that I could help." He turned and started the cruiser, looked at us one more time, and drove away. Yin and I hurried back to our vehicle, and as we pulled back onto the main road, I noticed he was smiling. "Do you think you understand the third extension now?" he asked. "Think about all that it entails." I looked at him for a moment, pondering his question. The key to this extension, it seemed, was the idea that our fields can boost others, lifting people into a higher awareness where they can tap into their own guiding intuitions. What expanded this idea for me beyond anything I had heard in Peru was the concept that our prayer field flows out in front of us, and that we can set it to uplift everyone around us, even though we aren't talking to them directly or even seeing their faces. We can do this by visualizing fully that it is happening, by expecting it. Of course, one has to be totally non-controlling with this energy, otherwise it backfires, as I had seen when I tried to make Jacob stop his vehicle. I mentioned all this to Yen. "What you are understanding is the contagious aspect of the human mind," Yin explained. "In a sense, we all share minds. Certainly, we have control over ourselves and can pull back, cut ourselves off, think independently. But, as I said earlier, the prevailing human worldview is always a giant field of belief and expectation. The key to human progress is to have enough people who can beam a higher expectation of love into this human field. This effort allows us to build an ever higher level of energy and to inspire each other toward our greatest potential." Yin seemed to relax for a moment and smiled over at me. "The culture of Shambhala," he said, "is built around setting such a field." I couldn't help smiling back. This journey was beginning to make sense in a way I couldn't yet articulate. The next 2 days went smoothly, with no sign of the Chinese military. Still on the southern route, heading northwest, we crossed another river near the top of Manyunla, a high mountain pass. The scenery was spectacular, with icy mountain peaks on each side of the road. We spent the first night at Horku, in an unmarked roadhouse that Yen knew about, and proceeded the next morning toward Lake Manasarovar. As we approached the lake, Yen said, "Here we will have to be very careful again. The lake and Mount Kailash further on are key destinations for people from all over the region, India, Nepal, China, as well as Tibet. It is a holy place like no other. There will be many pilgrims as well as Chinese checkpoints." Several miles ahead, Yin pulled off on an old track and we made our way around one of the checkpoints, then caught sight of the lake. I looked at Yin, who smiled. The sight was unbelievably beautiful. A huge turquoise pearl set against the rocky brown olive terrain, all framed against the snow-covered mountains in the background. One of the mountains, Yin pointed out, was Kailash. As we drove past the lake, we could see numerous groups of pilgrims standing around large poles strung with flags. "What are those?" I asked. "Prayer flags," Yin replied. "Placing flags symbolizing our prayers has been a tradition in Tibet for centuries. The prayer flags are left to flap in the wind, and this sends the prayers they contain continually out to God. Prayer flags are also given to people." "What kind of prayers do the flag contain?" "Prayers for love to prevail in all of humanity." I was silent. "Ironic, isn't it?" Yin added. "The culture of Tibet is totally dedicated to the spiritual life. We are arguably the most religious people anywhere. And we have been attacked by the most atheistic government on earth, that of China. It is a perfect contrast for all the world to see. One vision or the other will prevail." Without talking further, we drove through another small town and then into Darchin, The closest town to Mount Kailash, where Yin hired two mechanics he knew to check our jeep for any potential problems. We made camp with the other locals as close to the mountain as we could get, without arousing suspicion. I couldn't keep my eyes off the icy peaks. "From here, Kailash looks like a pyramid," I said. Yin nodded. "What does that tell you?" "It has power." As the sun sank below the horizon, we observed an amazing sight. A magnificent sunset filled the western sky with layer upon layer of peach-colored clouds, and at the same time, the sun below the horizon still shone on the face of Mount Kailash, turning its snowy slopes into a dazzling spectacle of yellow and orange. "All through history," Yin said, "great emperors have traveled thousands of miles on horseback or by carrier to witness these sights in Tibet. It was thought that the first light in the morning and the last light in the evening had great rejuvenating and visionary powers." I nodded as he talked, unable to look away from the majestic light around me. I did feel rejuvenated and almost calm. In front of us, toward Kailash, the flat valleys and low foothills were bathed in alternate layers of shadow and light brown reflections, providing an eerie contrast to the sunlit higher ridges, which seemed to glow from within. The sight was surrealistic, and for the first time, I realized why the Tibetans were so spiritual. The light of this land alone led them inexorably into a fuller awareness. Early the next morning, we were on our way again, and in 5 hours we had reached the outskirts of Ali. The sky was overcast, and the temperature was falling rapidly. Yin made several turns on nearly impassable roads in order to miss the main part of town. "This is mainly a Chinese area now," Yin said, "with bars and strip joints for the soldiers. We want to get through without anyone noticing us." When we hit a decent road again, we were already north of town. At one point, I caught sight of a newly built office building with several newer trucks parked outside. No one was moving anywhere on the grounds. Yin saw it at the same time and turned off the main road into an old driveway and stopped. "That's a new Chinese facility," he said. "I didn't know it was here. Watch and see if anyone there observes us as we go by." At that moment, a wind came up and it began to snow heavily, helping to obscure our identity. As we drove on, I looked very closely at the ground. Most of the windows of the building were draped. "What is that place?" I asked. "An oil exploration station, I think, but who knows?" "What's with this weather?" "It looks like a storm is coming in. This could help us." "You're thinking they might be looking for us up here, aren't you?" I asked. He looked at me with a profound sadness, which turned into a furious anger. "This is the town where my father was killed," he said. I shook my head. "It's terrible that you had to see that." "It has happened to thousands of Tibetans," he added, staring straight ahead. I could feel his hatred. He shook his head. "It is important not to think about that. We have to avoid such images, especially you. As I told you before, I may not be able to control my anger. You must do better than me with this problem so that you can go on alone if necessary." "What?" "Listen to me closely," he said. "You must understand exactly where you are. You have learned the first three extensions. You have been able to consistently raise your energy and create a strong field, but like me, you still fall into fear and anger. There are some other things I can tell you about anchoring your outflow of energy." "What do you mean by anchor?" I asked. "You must stabilize your flow of energy better, so that it is coming out of you into the world strongly, no matter what your situation is. When you do this, all three of the extensions that you have learned become a constant mindset and a way of life."
"Is this the fourth extension?" I asked.
"It is the beginning of the fourth. What I am about to tell you is the last information we have about the extensions. The rest of the fourth extension is known clearly only to those in Shambhala. Ideally,
the extensions should work together like this. Your prayer energy should come from your divine connection within and flow out in front of you, bringing forth the expected synchronicity and uplifting everyone it touches into his or her higher self. In this way, it maximizes the mysterious evolution of our lives and the awareness of and completion of our individual missions on this planet. Unfortunately, we hit bumps in the road, challenges that bring on a state of fear, which, as we have discussed, brings on doubt and thus collapses our fields. Worse, this fear can bring on negative images, bad expectations, which can help create what we fear in our lives. What you must learn now is a way of anchoring your higher energy so that you stay in the positive flow more often. The problem with fear, Yen went on, is that it can be very subtle and sneak up on us quickly. You see, a fear image is always about some outcome we don't want. We fear failing, embarrassing ourselves or our families, losing our freedom or someone we love or our own lives. The difficult part is that when we begin to feel such fear, it often turns into anger, and we use this anger to marshal our forces and fight back against whoever we feel is the threat. Whether we are feeling fear or anger, we have to realize that these emotions come from one source, those aspects of our lives we want to hold on to. The legends say that since fear and anger come from being concerned that we are going to lose something, the way to avoid these emotions is to be detached from all outcomes. We were well north of town now, and the snow was falling even heavier. Yen was straining to see the road and glanced only briefly at me as he talked. "Take our case, for instance," he said. "We are looking for Will and the gateway to Shambhala. The legends would say that at the same time we set our fields to expect just the right intuitions and events to guide us, we should detach totally from any particular outcome. This is what I was getting at when I cautioned you about being too attached to whether Jacob stalked or not. The importance of detachment is the great message of the Buddha and the gift to humanity provided by all Eastern religions." I was familiar with the concept, but at the moment, I was having trouble seeing its value. "Yen," I protested, "how can we detach completely? This idea often sounds like an ivory tower theory to me. It may be a matter of life and death that we help Will. How can we not care about that?" Yen pulled the Jeep off the road and stopped. Visibility was now near zero. "I didn't say not to care," he continued. "I said not to be attached to any particular outcome. What we get in life is always slightly different from what we want anyway. To be detached is to realize that there is always a higher purpose that can be found in any event, in any outcome. We can always find a silver lining, a positive meaning that we can build on." I nodded. This was a concept I knew from Peru. "I understand," I said, "the value of looking at things that way generally, but doesn't such an outlook have its limits? What if we are about to be killed or tortured? It's hard to be detached about that or to see a silver lining." Yen stared at me hard. "But what if being tortured is always the result of us not being detached enough during the events leading up to such a critical situation? Our legends say that when we learn detachment, our energy can remain high enough to avoid all these extremely negative occurrences. If we can stay strong, always expecting the positive, whether the outcome was exactly what we thought or not, then miracles begin to happen." I couldn't believe this. "Are you saying that everything bad that happens to us occurs because we missed some synchronistic opportunity to avoid it?" He looked at me with a smile. "Yes. That's exactly what I'm saying. But that's awful. Doesn't that assign blame? Say to someone who has a terminal disease, thinking that it's his own fault he's sick because he missed the opportunity to find healing?" "No, there is no blame. We all do the best we can. But what I have told you is a truth we must accept if we are to reach the highest levels of prayer energy. We must keep our fields as strong as possible, and to do this, we must always believe with a powerful faith that we will be saved from such problems. At times, we will miss something, he continued. Human knowledge is incomplete, and we may die or be tortured because of a lack of information. But the truth is this. If we had all the knowledge that humans will eventually have, we would always be guided out of a perilous situation. We reach our greatest power when we assume this is the case already. This is the way we can stay detached and flexible and build a powerful field of expectation. It was all beginning to make sense. Yen was telling me we had to assume that the synchronistic process would always take us out of harm's way, that we would know ahead of time which moves to make, because that ability is our destiny. If we believe that, sooner or later, it would become a reality for all humans. All the great mystics, Yin went on, say that operating from total faith is important. The Apostle John, in your Western Bible, describes the result of this kind of faith. They put him in a vat of boiling oil, and he was unharmed. Others were placed with hungry lions, and they remained safe. Are these merely myths? But how high does our faith have to be to achieve this level of invulnerability? I asked. We have to reach a level approaching those in Shambhala, Yin replied. Don't you see how it all fits together? If our ongoing prayer expectation is strong enough, we both expect synchronicity and send energy to others so they can also expect synchronicity. The level of energy keeps going up. And in the meantime, there is always the Dakini. He looked away quickly, apparently horrified that he had mentioned these beings again. What about the Dakini? I asked. He was silent. Yin, I pressed, you have to tell me what you mean. How do the Dakini fit into all of this? Finally, he took a breath and said, I'm telling you only what I myself understand. The legends say the Dakini are understood only by those in Shambhala, and that we must be very careful. I can't tell you more. I looked at him angrily. Well, we'll just have to find out later, won't we, when we reach Shambhala. He looked at me with great sadness. I already told you I have had too much experience with the Chinese military. My hate and anger erode my energy. If at any time I see that I am holding you back, I will have to leave, and you will have to go on alone. I stared at him, not wanting to contemplate that idea. Just remember, he continued, what I said about being detached and about trusting that you will always be guided past any danger. He paused a moment as he started the jeep and drove on through the blowing snow. You can bet, he finally said, that your faith will be tested. 6. The passage. After traveling north for 40 minutes, Yen turned onto a well-worn truck road and headed toward a high mountain chain 20 or 30 miles away. The snow continued to get heavier. Faintly at first, and then steadily growing louder, a low drone rose above the engine noise and wind. Yen and I looked at each other as the sounds finally became recognizable. Helicopters! Yin yelled, pulling the jeep off the track and through an opening in the rocks. The jeep bounced wildly. I knew it! They have some way of flying in this weather. What do you mean you knew it? As the sounds rose above us, I thought I heard two craft. One was hovering directly over us. This is my fault! Yin screamed over the noise. You must get out! Now! What? I yelled. Are you crazy? Where will I go? He yelled into my ear. Don't forget to stay alert. Do you hear me? Keep going northwest to Dorma. You must get to the Kunlun Mountains. With one deft move, he opened my door and shoved me out. I landed on my feet, then tumbled several times into a snowbank. I sat up and struggled to catch sight of the jeep,
but it was already driving away and the blowing snow obscured my view. A wave of sheer panic filled me. At that moment, a movement to the right caught my attention. Through the snow, I could see the figure of a tall man about 10 feet away, dressed in black yak leather pants and a sheepskin vest and hat. He was standing still, staring intensely at me, but his face was partially covered by a wool scarf. I recognized those eyes. From where? After a few more seconds, he looked up toward the helicopter, which was making another pass, and dashed away. Without warning, 3 or 4 terrific explosions erupted in the direction the jeep had gone, blowing rocks and snow all over me and filling the air with a choking smoke. I got up and staggered away as several more small explosions echoed around me. The blowing air was now completely filled with some kind of noxious gas. My head began to spin. I heard the music before I was completely conscious. It was a classic Chinese composer I had heard before. I jerked awake and realized I was in an elaborate Chinese-style bedroom. I sat up in the ornate bed and pushed back the silk sheets. I was clothed only in a hospital gown, and I had been bathed. The room was at least 20 by 20 feet, and each paneled wall had a different mural. A Chinese woman was peeking at me through the crack in the door. The door opened, and in walked an erect Chinese military officer in full uniform. A chill went through me. It was the same official I had now seen several times. My heart pounded. I tried to extend my energy, but the sight of the officer completely deflated me. "Good morning," the man said. "How do you feel?" "Considering I was gassed," I replied, "pretty good." He smiled. "It has no lasting effect, I assure you." "Where am I?" "You are in Ali. The doctors have seen you, and you are fine, but I must ask you some questions. Why were you traveling with Mr. Delo, and where were you going?" "We wanted to visit some of the old monasteries."
"Why?"
I decided not to tell him anymore.
"Because I'm a tourist. I have a visa."
"Why was I attacked? Does the American embassy know I'm being held?"
He smiled and looked ominously into my eyes.
"I am Colonel Chang. No one knows you are here, and if you have broken our laws, no one can help you. Mr. Delo is a criminal, a member of an illegal religious organization which is perpetrating a fraud in Tibet." My worst fears seemed to be happening.
"I don't know anything about that," I said. "I would like to call someone."
"Why are Mr. Delo and the others looking for this Shambhala?"
"I don't know what you are talking about."
He took a step closer to me.
"Who is Wilson James?"
"He's a friend of mine," I said.
"Is he in Tibet?"
"I think so, but I haven't seen him." Chang looked at me with a hint of disgust and, without saying anything else, turned and walked out. "This is bad," I thought, "very bad." I was about to get out of bed when the nurse returned with 6 soldiers, one of them pushing what looked like a huge iron lung, only it was bigger, and standing on tall, wide legs, apparently so that it could be rolled up over someone who was lying in a bed. Before I could say anything, the soldiers were holding me and rolling the machine over my body. The nurse turned it on, producing a mild humming noise and a bright light directly over my face. Even with my eyes closed, I could see the light move from right to left across my head like the scanner of a copy machine. As soon as the machine stopped, the soldiers rolled the device away and left the room. The nurse lingered a moment, looking me over.
"What was that?" I stammered.
"Just an encephalograph," she said in careful English as she reached into a cabinet and pulled out my clothes. They had been cleaned and folded neatly.
"What was it for?" I pressed.
"To check everything, to make sure you are all right." At that moment, the door opened again and Colonel Chang returned. He picked up a chair by the wall and set it near my bed.
"Perhaps I should tell you what we are faced with here," he said as he sat down in the chair.
He looked tired.
"There are many religious sects in Tibet, and many of their adherents seek to give the impression around the world that they are a religious people being oppressed by the Chinese. And I admit that our early policies in the 1950s and during the Cultural Revolution were harsh. But these policies have been changed in recent years. We are trying to be as tolerant as we can, given that the official policy of the Chinese government is atheism. These sects must remember that Tibet has changed as well. Many Chinese live here now, and have always lived here, and many of them are not Buddhists. We must all live together. There is no way that Tibet can ever return to Lamaist rule. You understand what I am saying? The world has changed. Even if we wanted to give Tibet its freedom, it would not be fair to the Chinese. He waited for me to say something, and I thought about confronting him with the government policy of importing Chinese nationals into Tibet in order to dilute the Tibetan culture. Instead, I said, I think they just want to be free to pursue their religion without interference. We have allowed some of that, but they are always changing what they are doing. Once we think we know who is in charge, the situation changes. I think we are arriving at a good relationship with parts of the official Buddhist hierarchy. But then, there are the Tibetan expatriates in India, and this other group that Mr. Dolo is a part of, the one that follows some cryptic verbal knowledge and is stirring up all this talk about Shambhala. It is distracting to the people. There is much important work to be done in Tibet. The people are very poor. The quality of life must be raised. He looked at me and grinned. Why is this legend of Shambhala being taken so seriously? It seems almost juvenile, the idea of children. The Tibetans believe that there is another, more spiritual reality beyond the physical worlds we can see, and that Shambhala, while here on this earth, lies in this spiritual realm. I couldn't believe I was risking a debate with him. But how could they think this place exists? He continued. We have surveyed every inch of Tibet from the air and from satellites, and we have seen nothing. I was silent. Do you know where this place is supposed to be? He pressed. Is that why you are here? I would love to know where it is, I said, or even what it is, but I'm afraid I don't. I also don't want to be in trouble with the Chinese authorities. He was listening intently, so I continued. In fact, all this scares the hell out of me, and I would really rather leave. Oh, no. All we want is for you to share what you know, he said. If such a place exists, if it is a hidden culture, we want to know this information. Share your knowledge with us and let us help you. Perhaps there is a compromise that could be made. I looked at him for a moment and said, I would like to contact the American Embassy, if that's okay. He tried to hide his impatience, but I could see it clearly in his eyes. He stared at me for a moment longer, then walked to the door and turned around. That's not necessary, he said. You are free to go. Minutes later, I was walking down the streets of Ali, zipping up my parka tightly. It was not snowing now, but it was very cold. Earlier, I had been forced to dress in front of the nurse and then escorted from the house. As I continued to walk, I went through the contents of my pockets. Surprisingly, everything was there. A knife, my wallet, a small bag of almonds. I felt lightheaded and fatigued. Was this from the anxiety, I wondered? The effects of the gas, the altitude. I tried to shake it off. Ali was a modern town with numerous Chinese and Tibetans walking the streets and vehicles everywhere. Its well-kept buildings and stores were slightly disconcerting, given the terrible roads and conditions we had just traveled through to get here. Looking around, I could see no one who I thought might be able to speak English, and after several blocks, I began to feel even more lightheaded. I had to sit down beside the road on an old cement block. The growing fear almost became a panic. What was I to do now? What had happened to Yen? Why had the Chinese colonel let me go like that? It made no sense. With that thought, a full image of Yen appeared in my mind, and I felt a reminder. I was letting my energy collapse. The fear was overwhelming me, and I had forgotten to do anything about it.
I took a deep breath and attempted to raise my energy. A few minutes later, I began to feel better, and my eyes fell on a large building several blocks away. It had a sign on the side in Chinese that I couldn't read, but as I focused on the shape of the building, I got the distinct impression that it was a guest house or a small hotel. I felt elated. There would be a phone there, perhaps, maybe even other tourists I could hook up with. I stood up and walked in that direction, careful to keep an eye on the streets around me. In a few minutes, I was several doors away from the Xing Shui guest house, but I felt hesitant and looked around carefully. No one seemed to be following me. When I was almost to the door, I heard a noise. Something had landed in the snow. I looked around. I was standing on the street directly across from a narrow alleyway, alone, except for several old men walking in the other direction, 20 feet away. I heard the noise again. It was close. As I was looking down at my feet, I saw a small stone fly out of the alley and plop into the snow. Taking one step forward, I tried to look down the shadowed opening. I took several more steps, trying to adjust my eyes. "It's me," a voice said. I knew immediately it was Yen. I rushed into the alley, finding him leaning against a brick wall. "How did you know where I was?" I asked. "I didn't know," came his reply. "I was just guessing." He slid down the wall and sat down, and I noticed his parka was burned on the back. When he moved his arm, I saw a patch of blood on his shoulder. "You're hurt," I said. "What's wrong?" "It's not that bad. They dropped a concussion bomb, and I hit rocks when I was thrown from the jeep. I managed to crawl away before they landed. I saw them take you and load you onto a truck headed back here. I figured if you got away, you would head toward the largest guest house. What happened to you?" I told Yen about waking up in the Chinese house and being interrogated by Colonel Chang, then released. "Why did you push me out of the jeep?" I asked. "I told you before," Yen replied. "I can't control my fearful expectations. My hatred for the Chinese is too great. They are able to follow me." He paused. "Why did they release you?" "I don't know," I replied. Yen moved slightly and grimaced in pain. "Probably because Chang senses that he can follow you, too." I was shaking my head. Could this be real? "He wouldn't know how it works, of course," Yen continued. "But when you expect the soldiers to come, your expectation actually gives his ego the thought to approach where you are. He probably thinks it is some power in him." He looked at me hard. "You must learn from my problem. You must master your thoughts." Yen looked at me a moment longer, then holding his arm, led me down the alley through a narrow gap between two buildings and into what looked to be an abandoned building. "We need to get you to a doctor," I said. "No," Yen said forcefully. "Listen to me. I will be fine. There are people here who can help me, but I can't go with you to the ruins of the old monastery. You will have to go there by yourself." I turned away, fear swelling inside me. "I don't think I can do that." Yen looked alarmed. "You must control your fear. Return to detachment. You are needed to help find Shambhala. You must go on." He struggled to sit up, grimacing as he moved closer to me. "Don't you understand that the Tibetan people have suffered much, yet they have waited for the day that Shambhala would be known to all the world?" He squinted as his look found my eyes. "Think of how many people have helped us get this far. Many of them have risked everything. Some may be imprisoned, even shot." I lifted up my hand and showed it to him. It was shaking. "Look at me. I can barely move." Yin's eyes were piercing. "Don't you think your father was terrified when he struggled out of that landing craft and ran onto the beaches of France in World War II, just like all the others? But he did that. What if he hadn't? What if all of the rest of them hadn't? That war could have been lost. Freedom for everyone could have been lost. We in Tibet have lost our freedom, but what is happening now is about more than just Tibet.
It is about more than you or me. It is about what must happen for all the sacrifices of many generations to be honored.
Understanding Shambhala, learning to use the prayer fields at this moment in history, is next in the evolution of humankind. It is the great chore of our whole generation. If we fail, then we let down everyone who came before us.